slightly back and forward. West wondered if it was the first time he had seen the old warrior smile. He jerked a thumb down the hill.
"Tull's having a piss. I'm singing. I'm drunk as fucking shit."
He fell slowly backwards and crunched down into the snow, arms and legs spread out wide.
"And I've been smoking. I'm soaked. I'm wet as a fucking critter. Where are we, Dow?"
Dow squinted across the fire, mouth wide open, like he was looking at something far away.
"Middle of fucking nowhere," he said, waving the pipe around.
He started cackling, grabbed hold of Three Tree's boot and shook it.
"Where else would we be? You want this, Furious?"
He thrust the pipe up at West.
"All right."
He sucked on the stem, felt the smoke biting in his lungs. He coughed brown steam out into the frosty air and sucked again.
"Give me that,"
said Three Trees, sitting up and snatching the pipe off him. Tull's great rumbling voice came floating up out of the darkness, horribly out of tune.
"He swung his axe like... was it? He swung his axe like... shit. No, hold on."
"Do you know where Cathal is?" asked West. Dow leered up at him.
"Oh, she's around."
He waved his hand toward a cluster of tents higher up the slope.
"Up that way, I reckon."
"Around?"
echoed Three Trees, chuckling softly.
"Around? He was the bloody nine,"
came gurgling from the trees. West followed footprints off up the slope towards the tents. The smoke was already having an effect on him. His head felt light, his feet moved easily. His nose didn't feel cold anymore, just pleasantly tingling. He heard a woman's voice, laughing softly. He grinned, took a few more crunching steps through the snow towards the tents. Warm light spilled out from one through a narrow gap in the cloth. The laughter grew louder. West frowned. That didn't sound like laughter. He came closer, doing his best to be quiet. Another sound wandered into his fuzzy mind, an intermittent growling like some kind of animal. He edged closer still, bending down to peer through the gap, hardly daring even to breathe. He saw a woman's bare back squirming up and down. A thin back, he could see the sinews bunching as she moved, the knobbles of her backbone shifting under her skin. Closer still, and he could see her hair, shaggy brown and messy. Cathal. A pair of sinewy legs stuck out from under her towards West, one foot almost close enough for him to touch, its thick toes wriggling. A hand slid up under her armpit, another round behind one knee. There was a low growl, and the lovers, if you could call them that, rolled smoothly over so she was underneath. West's mouth dropped open. He could see the side of the man's head, and he stared at it. There was no mistaking the sharp, stubbly jawline. The dog man. His ass was sticking up towards West, moving in and out. Cathal's hand clutched at one hairy buttock, squeezing at it in time to the movement. West clamped one hand over his mouth, eyes bulging, half horrified, half strangely aroused. He was caught hopelessly between wanting to watch and wanting to run, and came down on the latter without thinking. He took a step back, his heel caught a tent peg, and he went sprawling over with a stifled cry.
"What the fuck?"
he heard from inside the tent. He scrambled up and turned away, started to flounder through the snow in the darkness as he heard the flap thrown back.
"Which of you is it, you bastards?"
came Dogman's voice from above, bellowing in northern.
"That you, Dow? I'll fucking kill you!"
Chapter 41 The High Places.
"The Broken Mountains," breathed Brother Longfoot, his voice hushed with awe. "Truly a magnificent sight."
"I think I'd like it better if I didn't have to climb 'em," grunted Logan.
Giselle by no means disagreed. The character of the land they rode through had been changing day by day,
from softly sloping grassland to gently rolling plains to buckled hills spattered with bare rocks and sullen groups of stunted trees. Always in the distance had been the dim grey rumours of the mountain peaks, growing larger and more distinct with each morning, until they seemed to pierce the brooding clouds themselves. Now they sat in their very shadow. The long valley they had been following with its waving trees and winding stream ended at a maze of broken walls. Beyond it lay a steep rise into the rugged foothills. Beyond them, the first true outline of the mountains rose. A stark outline of jagged rock, proud and magnificent, smeared at the distant top with white snow. A child's vertiginous notion of what a mountain should be. Baez swept the ruined foundations with his hard green eyes.
There was a strong fortress here. It marked the western limits of the empire before pioneers crossed the pass and settled the valleys on the far side.
The place was nothing more now than a home for stinging weeds and scratching brambles. The Magus clambered from the cart and squatted down, stretching out his back and working his legs, grimacing all the while. He still looked old and ill, but a great deal of both flesh and colour had returned to his face since they left Alcus behind.
"Here ends my rest," he sighed. "This cart has served as well, and the beasts too, but the pass will be too steep for horses."
Giselle saw the track now, switching back and forth as it climbed, a faint line through the piles of wild grass and steep rock, lost over a ridge high above.
"It looks a long way,"
Baez snorted.
"But the first descent of many we will make today, and there will be many more beyond them. We will be a week at least in the mountains, my boy, if all goes well."
Giselle hardly dared ask what might happen if things went badly.
"We must travel light. We have a long, steep road to follow. Water and all the food we have left. Warm clothes, for it will be bitter cold among the peaks."
"The birth of spring is perhaps not the best time to cross a mountain range," observed Longfoot under his breath.
Baez looked sharply sideways.
"Some would say the best time to cross an obstacle is when one finds oneself on the wrong side of it. Or do you suggest we wait for summer?"
The navigator chose, wisely in Giselle's opinion, not to reply.
"The pass is well sheltered in the main. The weather should be far from our most pressing worry. We will need ropes, though. The road was good, in the old time, if narrow, but that was long ago. It might have been washed away in places, or tumbled into deep valleys, who knows? We may have some tough climbing ahead of us."
"I can hardly wait," muttered Giselle.
"Then there is this."
The Magus pulled one of the nearly empty fodder sacks open, pushed the hay out of the way with his bony hands. The box they had taken from the house of the Maker lay in its bottom, a block of darkness among the pale dry grass.
"And who gets the joy of carrying that bastard?"
Logan looked up from under his brows.
"How about we draw lots, no?"
No one said anything. The Northman grunted as he hooked his hands under it and dragged it off the cart towards him, its edge squealing against the wood.
"Reckon it's me, then," he said, thick veins standing out from his neck as he hauled the weighty thing onto a blanket.
Giselle did not at all enjoy looking at it. It reminded him too much of the suffocating hallways of the Maker's house, of Baez's dark stories about magic and demons and the other side, of the fact that there was a purpose to this journey that he did not understand, but definitely did not like the sound of. He was glad when Logan finally had it wrapped up in blankets and stowed in a pack. Out of sight, at least, if not entirely out of mind. They all had plenty to carry. Giselle took his steels, of course, sheathed at his belt. The clothes he wore, the least stained, torn, and reeking he possessed, his ripped and battered one-armed coat over the top. He had a spare shirt in his pack, a coil of rope above it, and half their stock of food on top of that. He almost wished that were heavier. They were down to their last box of biscuits, half a sack of oatmeal, and a packet of salted fish that disgusted everyone except Kwai. He rolled up a pair of blankets and belted them to the top of his pack, hung a full canteen at his waist, and was ready to go. As ready as he was going to get, anyway. Kwai unhitched the cart horses, while Giselle stripped the saddles and harness from the other two. It seemed hardly fair, leaving them in the middle of nowhere after they had carried them all the way from Kalsis. It felt like years ago to Giselle, thinking back. He was a different man now from the one who had set out from that city across the plain. He almost winced to remember his arrogance and his ignorance and his selfishness.
"Yah!"
he shouted. His horse looked at him sadly without moving, then put its head down and began to nibble at the grass near his feet. He rubbed its back fondly. "Well, I suppose they will find their way in time." "Or not," grunted Pharaoh, drawing her sword. "What are you—" The curved blade chopped halfway through the neck of Giselle's horse, spattering warm, wet specks in his stricken face. Its front legs crumpled and it slid to the ground, toppled onto its side, blood gushing out into the grass. Pharaoh grabbed hold of one of its hooves, hauled it towards her with one hand, and started hacking the leg from the carcass with short, efficient blows, while Giselle stared, his mouth open. She scowled up at him. "I'm not leaving all this meat for the birds. It will not keep long, but we will eat well enough tonight, at least. Get that sack." Logan flung one of the empty feed bags to her and shrugged. "You can't get attached to things, Giselle. Not out here in the wild." No one spoke as they began to climb. They all were bent over and concentrating on the crumbling track beneath their shuffling feet. The path rose and turned back, rose and turned back time after time. And soon Giselle's legs were aching, his shoulders were sore, his face was damp with sweat. One step at a time. That was what West used to tell him when he was flagging on the long runs round the Agriont. One step at a time, and he had been right. Left foot, right foot, and up they went. After a spell of this repetitive effort, he stopped and looked down. It was amazing how high they had climbed in so short a time. He could see the foundations of the ruined fortress, grey outlines in the green turf at the foot of the pass. Beyond it, the rutted track led back through the crumpled hills towards Alcus. Giselle gave a sudden shudder and turned back towards the mountains. Better to leave all that behind him. Logan slogged up the steep path, his worn boots scraping and crunching in the gravel and the dirt, the metal box in his pack a dead weight that dragged on his shoulders and seemed to get heavier with each step, that dug into his flesh like a bag of nails, even though it was wrapped in blankets. But Logan was not so very bothered by it. He was too busy watching Pharaoh's arse move as she walked ahead of him, lean muscles squeezing with every step under the stained canvas of her trousers. It was an odd thing. Before he'd fucked her, he hadn't thought about her that way at all. He'd been too concerned with trying to stop her running off, or shooting him, or stabbing one of the others. So busy watching her scowl that he hadn't seen her face. So busy watching her hands that he'd never noticed the rest of her. Now he couldn't think about anything else. Every movement of hers seemed fascinating. He'd catch himself watching her all the time, while they were on the move, while they were sitting down, while she was eating or drinking or talking or spitting, while she was pulling her boots on in the morning or pulling them off at night. To make matters worse, his cock was halfway hard the whole time from watching her out of the corners of his eyes and imagining her naked. It was getting to be quite an embarrassment. "What are you looking at?" Logan stopped and gazed up into the sun. Pharaoh was frowning down at him. He stood and shifted the pack on his back, rubbing at his sore shoulders, wiping a sheen of sweat from his forehead. He could have thought up a lie easily enough. He'd been watching the magnificent mountain peaks. He'd been watching where he put his feet. He'd been checking that her pack was on right. But what would have been the point? They both knew well enough what he'd been looking at, and the others had pushed on well out of earshot.
"I'm looking at your arse," he said, shrugging his shoulders.
"Sorry, but it's a good one. No harm looking, is there?"
She opened her mouth angrily, but he put his head down and trudged round her before she had the chance to speak, his thumbs hooked under the straps of his pack. When he'd got 10 paces or so, he looked over his shoulder. She was still standing there, hands on her hips, frowning up at him. He grinned back.
"What are you looking at?" he said.
They stopped for water in the cold, fresh morning, on a ledge above a plunging valley. Through spreading trees, heavy with red berries, growing sideways from the bare rock, Giselle could see white water surging in its narrow bottom. Dizzying cliffs rose on the far side, sheets of grey stone not far from sheer, ending in towering crags high above, where dark birds flapped and crowed to each other, while swirls of white cloud turned in the pale sky beyond. A spectacular setting, if somewhat unsettling.
"Beautiful," murmured Giselle, but taking care not to get too close to the edge.
Logan nodded.
"Reminds me of home. When I was a lad, I used to spend weeks at a time up in the high places, testing myself against the mountains."
He took a swallow from the flask, then handed it to Giselle, staring up through narrowed eyes at the dark peaks.
"They always win, though. This empire's come and gone, and here they still are. Looking down on it all. Here they'll still be, long after all of us have gone back to the mud. They look down on my home."
He gave a long snort, then spat phlegm over the edge of the valley.
"Now they look down on nothing."
Giselle took a swallow of water himself.
"Will you go back to the north after this?"
"Maybe. I've some scores to settle. Some deep, hard scores."
The Northman shrugged his shoulders.
"But if I let them lie, I dare say no one would be the worse off. I reckon they all think I'm dead, and no one's anything but relieved about it."
"Nothing to go back to?"
Logan winced.
"Nothing but more blood. My family's long dead and rotted, and those friends I didn't turn on and kill myself, I got killed with my pride and my stupidity. So much for my achievements. But you've still got time, eh, Giselle? A good chance at a nice, peaceful life. What will you do?"
"Well, I've been thinking."
He cleared his throat, suddenly nervous, as though giving voice to his plans made them far closer to reality.
"There's a girl back home. Well, a woman, I suppose. My friend's sister, in fact. Her name is Adi. I think that perhaps I love her."
It was strange that he was discussing his innermost feelings with this man he had thought a savage, with this man who could understand nothing of the delicate rules of life in the Union, of the sacrifice that Giselle was considering. But somehow it was easy to say.
"I've been thinking, well, if she'll have me, perhaps, we might marry."
"That sounds like a good plan."
Logan grinned and nodded.
"Marry her and sow some seeds."
Giselle raised his eyebrows.
"I don't know much about farming."
The Northman spluttered with laughter.
"Not those kind of seeds, boy."
He clapped him on the arm.
"One piece of advice, though, if you'll take one from the likes of me. Find something to do with your life that don't involve killing."
He bent and swung up his pack, shoved his arms through the straps.
"Leave the fighting to those with less sense."
And he turned and struggled up the track. Giselle nodded slowly to himself. He touched one hand to the scar on his chin, his tongue finding the hole in his teeth. Logan was right. Fighting was not the life for him. He already had one scar too many. It was a bright day. The first time Pharaoh had been warm in a long while, and the sun felt good, hot and angry on her face, on her bare forearms, on the backs of her hands. The shadows of rock and branch were laid out sharp on the stony ground,
The spray from the falling water that flowed beside the old track flashed as it fell through the air. The others had fallen behind. Longfoot, taking his time, smiling up at anything and everything, blathering on about the majesty of the views. Kwai, hunched up and dogged under the weight of his pack. Byers, wincing and sweating, puffing as though he might fall dead at any minute. Luthar, moaning about his blisters to anyone who would listen, which was no one. So it was only her and Ninefingers striding up ahead in stony silence. Just the way she liked it. She scrambled over a lip of crumbling rock and came upon a dark pool, lapping at a crescent of flat stones, water hissing and splattering down into it over piled-up rocks bearded with wet moss. A pair of twisted trees spread their branches out above, thin, fresh-budded leaves shimmering and rustling in the breeze. The sunlight sparkled, and insects skated and buzzed lazily on the rippling water. A beautiful place, most likely, if you thought that way. Pharaoh did not. "Fish in there," she murmured, licking her lips. A fish would be nice, stuck on a twig over a fire. The bits of horse they had carried with them were all gone, and she was hungry. She watched the vague shapes flicker under the shimmering water as she squatted down to fill up her canteen. Lots of fish. Ninefingers dumped his heavy pack and sat down on the rocks beside it, dragging his boots off. He rolled his trousers up above his knees. "What are you doing, Pink?" He grinned at her. "I'm going to tickle me some fish out of that pool." "With your hands? You got clever enough fingers for that?" "I reckon you'd know." She frowned at him, but he only smiled the wider, skin creasing up round the corners of his eyes. "Watch and learn, woman." And he paddled out, bent over, lips pressed tight together with concentration, feeling gently around in the water. "What's he up to?" Luthar dumped his pack down beside Pharaoh's and wiped his glistening face with the back of his hand. "Fool thinks he can catch a fish." "What, with his hands?" "Watch and learn, boy," muttered Ninefingers. "Ah!" His face broke out into a smile. "And here she is." The muscles in his forearm shifted as he worked his fingers under the water. "Got it!" And he snatched his hand up in a shower of spray. Something flashed in the bright sun, and he tossed it onto the bank beside them, leaving a trail of dark wet spots on the dry stones. A fish, flipping and jumping. "Ha-ha!" cried Longfoot, stepping up beside them. "Tricking fish out of the pool, is he? A most impressive and remarkable skill. I once met a man of the Thousand Isles who was reckoned the greatest fisherman in all the circle of the world. I do declare, he could sit upon the bank and sing, and the fish would jump into his lap. They would indeed." He frowned to find no one delighted by his tale, but now Byers was dragging himself over the lip, almost on hands and knees. His apprentice appeared behind him, face set hard. The first of the Magi tottered down, leaning heavily on his staff, and fell back against a rock.
"Perhaps we should camp here."
He gasped for breath, sweat running down his gaunt face.
"You would never guess I once ran through this pass. I made it in 2 days."
He let his staff drop from his trembling fingers, and it clattered down amongst the dry grey driftwood near the water's edge.
"Long ago."
"I've been thinking," muttered Luthar. Byers's tired eyes swiveled sideways, as though even turning his head might prove too much of an effort.
"Thinking and walking? Pray do not strain yourself, Captain Luthar."
"Why the edge of the world?" The Magus frowned.
"Not for the exercise, I assure you. What we seek is there."
"Yes, but why is it there?" "Huh," grunted Pharaoh in agreement. "A good question." Byers took a long breath and puffed out his cheeks.
"Never any rest, eh? After the destruction of Alcus, the fall of Glustrod, the three remaining sons of Eos met. Juvens, Bedesh, and Canadius.
they discussed what should be done with the seed.
"Have that!"
shouted Nine Fingers, pulling another fish from the water and flinging it onto the stones beside the first. Baez watched it, expressionless, as it squirmed and flopped, mouth and gills gulping desperately at the suffocating air.
Canadius desired to study it. He claimed he could turn it to righteous purposes. Juvens feared the stone, but knew of no way to destroy it, so he gave it into his brother's keeping. Over long years, though, as the wounds of the Empire failed to heal, he came to regret his decision. He worried that Canadius, hungry for power, might break the first law, as Glustrod had done. He demanded the stone be put beyond use. At first, the Maker refused, and the trust between the brothers dwindled. I know this, for I was the one who carried the messages between them. Even then, I learned since, they were preparing the weapons they would one day use against each other. Juvens begged, then pleaded, then threatened, and eventually Canadius relented. So the three sons of Eos journeyed to Shabulion.
"No place more remote in the whole circle of the world," muttered Longfoot.
"That is why it was chosen. They gave up the seed to the spirit of the island to keep safe until the end of time."
"They commanded the spirit never to release it," murmured Quai.
"My apprentice shows his ignorance again," returned Baez, glaring from under his bushy brows. "Not never, Master Quai. Juvens was wise enough to know that he could not guess all outcomes. He realized that a desperate time might come in some future age when the power of this thing might be needed. So Bedesh commanded the spirit to release it only to a man who carried Juven's staff." Longfoot frowned.
"Then where is it?"
Baez pointed to the length of wood he used for a stick, lying on the ground beside him, rough and unadorned.
"That's it?"
muttered Luthar, sounding more than a little disappointed.
"What did you expect, Captain?"
Baez grinned sideways at him.
10 feet of polished gold, inlaid with runes of crystal, topped by a diamond the size of your head?"
The Magus snorted.
"Even I have never seen a gem that big. A simple stick was good enough for my master. He needed nothing more. A length of wood does not by itself make a man wise, or noble, or powerful, any more than a length of steel does. Power comes from the flesh, my boy, and from the heart, and from the head. From the head most of all."
"I love this pool!"
cackled Nine Fingers, tossing another fish out onto the rocks.
"Juvens," murmured Longfoot softly. "And his brothers, powerful beyond guessing. Between men and gods, even they feared this thing. They went to such pains to put it beyond use. Should we not fear it as they did?"
Baez stared at Pharaoh, his eyes glittering, and she stared back. Beads of sweat stood from his wrinkled skin, darkened the hairs of his beard, but his face was flat as a closed door. "Weapons are dangerous to those who do not understand them. With Pharaoh Mal'jin's bow, I might shoot myself in the foot, if I did not know how to use it. With Captain Luthar's steel, I might cut my ally, had I not the skill. The greater the weapon, the greater the danger. I have the proper respect for this thing, believe me, but to fight our enemies, we need a powerful weapon indeed." Pharaoh frowned. She was yet to be convinced that her enemies and his were quite the same, but she would let it sleep for now. She had come too far and got too close not to see this business through. She glanced over at Nine Fingers and caught him staring at her. His eyes flicked away back to the water. She frowned deeper. He was always looking at her lately, staring and grinning and making bad jokes. And now she found herself looking at him more often than there was any need for. Patterns of light flowed across his face,
reflected from the rippling water. He looked up again, and their eyes met, and he grinned at her, just for an instant. Pharaoh's frown grew deeper yet. She pulled her knife out, snatched up one of the fish and took its head off, slit it open and flicked its slimy guts out, plopping down into the water next to Ninefinger's leg. It had been a mistake to fuck him, of course, but things had not turned out so very badly after all.
Ha!
Ninefingers sent up another glittering spray of water, then he stumbled, clutching at the air.
Ah!
The fish flapped from his hands, a streak of flipping brightness, and the Northman crashed into the water on his face. He came up spitting and shaking his head, hair plastered to his skull.
Bastard!
Every man has somewhere in the world an adversary cleverer than himself. Baez stretched out his legs in front of him. Could it be, Master Ninefingers, that you have finally found yours? Giselle woke with a start. It was the middle of the night. It took him a dizzy moment to remember where he was, for he had been dreaming of home, of the Agriant, of sunny days and balmy evenings. Of Ardi, or someone like her, smiling lopsided at him in his cozy living room. Now the stars were scattered bright and stark across the black sky, and the chill, sharp air of the high places nipped at Giselle's lips and his nostrils and the tips of his ears. He was back up in the broken mountains, half the width of the world from Adua, and he felt a pang of loss. At least his stomach was full. Fish and biscuit, the first proper meal he'd eaten since the horse ran out. There was still warmth from the fire on the side of his face, and he turned towards it, grinning at the glowing embers and dragging his blankets up under his chin. Happiness was nothing more than a fresh fish and a fire still alight. He frowned. The blankets beside him, where Logan had been sleeping, were moving around. At first he took it for the Northman turning in his sleep, but they carried on moving and did not stop. A slow, regular shifting, accompanied, Giselle now realized, by a soft grunting sound. He had taken it at first for Baez's snoring, but now he saw otherwise. Straining into the darkness, he made out Ninefinger's pale shoulder and arm, thick muscles straining. Under his arm, squeezing hard at his side, there was a dark-skinned hand. Giselle's mouth hung open. Logan and Pharaoh, and from the sound of it there could be no doubt they were coupling. What was more, not a stride from his head. He stared, watching the blankets bucking and shifting in the dim light from the fire. When had they... Why were they... How had they... It was a damned imposition, is what it was. His old distaste for them flooded back in a moment, and his scarred lip curled. A pair of savages, rutting in full view. He had half a mind to get up and kick them, as you might kick a pair of dogs who had, to the general embarrassment of all, unexpectedly taken to each other at a garden party.
Shit,
whispered a voice. Giselle froze, wondering if one of them had seen him.
Hold on.
There was a brief pause.
That's it.
The repetitive movement started up again, the blankets flapping back and forward, slowly to begin with, then faster. How could they possibly have expected him to sleep through this? He scowled and rolled away, pulling his own covers over his head, and lay there in the darkness, listening to Ninefinger's throaty grunting and Pharaoh's urgent hissing growing steadily louder. He squeezed his eyes shut and felt a sting of tears underneath his lids. Damn it, but he was lonely. Chapter 42 Coming Over. The road curved down from the west, down the bare white valley between two long ridges, all covered in dark pines. It met the river at the ford, the white flow running high with meltwater, fast flowing over the rocks and full of spit and froth, earning its name all right.
So, that's it then,
muttered Tull, lying on his belly and peering through the bushes.
I reckon, said Dogman.
Unless there's another giant fortress anywhere on the river. From up here on the ridge, the dogman could see its shape clear, towering great walls of sheer dark stones, perfectly six-sided, 12 strides high at the least, a massive round tower at each corner, the grey slate roofs of buildings round a courtyard in the midst. Just outside that, there was a smaller wall, 6 sides again, half as high but still high enough, studded with a dozen smaller towers. One side back to the river, the other 5 had a wide moat dug round them, so the whole thing was made an island of sharp stone. One bridge out to it, and one bridge only, stretching to a gatehouse the size of a hill.
"Shit on that," said Dow. "You ever seen walls the likes of those? How the hell did Bethel get in there?"
Dogman shook his head.
"Don't hardly matter how. He won't fit his whole army in it."
"He won't want to," said Three Trees. "Not Bethod. That's not his way. He'd rather be outside where he can move, waiting for his chance to catch him off guard."
"Huh?"
grunted Grim, nodding.
"Fucking Union," cursed Dow. "They're never on guard. All that time we followed Bethod up from the south, and they bloody let him pass without a fight. Now he's all walled up here, close to food and water, nice and happy, waiting for us."
Three Trees clicked his tongue.
"No point crying about it now, is there? Bethod got round you once or twice before, as I recall."
"Heh! Bastard's got one hell of a knack for turning up where he ain't wanted."
Dogman looked down at the fortress and the river behind, and the long valley, and the high ground on the other side covered with trees.
"He'll have men up on the ridge opposite, and down there in those woods round the moat too, I shouldn't wonder."
"Well, you got it all figured, don't you?" said Dow, looking sideways. "There's just one thing we still need to know. She suck your cock yet?"
"What?"
said the dogman, caught not knowing what to say. Tull spluttered with laughter. Three Trees started chuckling to himself. Even Grim made a kind of sound, like breath but louder.
"Simple question, isn't it?" asked Dow. "Has she or has she not sucked it?"
Dogman frowned and hunched his shoulders.
"Shit on that."
Tull could barely hold his giggling back.
"She did what to it? She shit on it? You was right, Dow. They don't do it the same down there in the Union."
Now they were all laughing, apart from the dogman, of course.
"Piss on the lot of you," he grunted. "Maybe you should suck each other's. At least it might shut you up."
Dow slapped him on the shoulder.
"Don't think so. You know how Tull is for talking with his mouth full."
Tull clamped his hand over his face and blew snot out of his nose. He was laughing so hard. Dogman gave him a look, but that was like hoping a look would stop a rock falling. It didn't.
"All right, now best be quiet," muttered Three Trees, but still grinning. "Someone better take a closer look. See if we can work out where Bethod's boys are all at, before the Union come fumbling up that roll like a pack of fools."
Dogman felt his heart sinking.
"One of us better. Which of you bastards is it going to be, then?"
Black Dow grinned as he slapped him on the shoulder.
"I reckon whoever got to stick his twig in the fire last night should be the one to face the cold this morning, eh, lads?"
Dogman crept down through the trees, bow in one hand, with a shaft knocked to it, but the string not pulled back, for fear of letting it go by accident and shooting himself in the leg or some foolishness. He'd seen that happen before, and he'd no wish to be hopping back to the camp, trying to explain to the others how he got one of his own arrows through his foot. He'd never hear the end of it. He knelt and peered through the trees, looked down at the ground, bare brown earth and patches of white snow and piles of wet pine needles, and he stopped breathing. There was a footprint near him, half in mud and half in snow. The snow was melting and falling off and on. A print wouldn't have lasted long today. That meant it was made recent. The dogman sniffed the air. Not much to smell, but it was harder to smell anything in the cold, nose all pink and numb and full of cold snot. He crept the way the footprint was pointing, looking all round. He saw another, and another. Someone had come this way, no doubt, and not long ago. You're the dog manager. He froze, heart thumping like big boots upstairs all of a sudden. He turned round to look where the voice came from. There was a man sitting on a fallen tree 10 strides away, lying back against a thick branch, hands clasped behind his head, stretched out like he was near asleep. He had long black hair hanging on his face, but one eye peered out at the dog man, watchful. He sat forward slowly. "Now, I'll leave these here," he said, pointing at a heavy axe half buried in the rotten trunk and a round shield leaning near it. "So you know I'm looking to talk, and I'll come on over. How's that sound to you?" Dogman raised his bow and drew the string back. "Come on over if you must, but if you try more and talk, I'll put an arrow through your neck." "Fair enough." Longhair rocked himself forward and slithered off the trunk, leaving his weapons behind, and came on through the trees. He walked with his head stooped over, but he was a tall bastard still, holding his hands up in the air, palms out. All peaceful-looking, no doubt, but the dogman wasn't taking no chances. Peaceful-looking and peaceful are two different things. "Might I say," said the man as he came closer, "in the interests of working up some trust between us, that you never saw me. If I'd had a bow, I could have shot you where you stood." It was a fair point, but the dogman didn't like it any. "You got a bow?" "No, I don't, as it goes." "There's your mistake, then," he snapped. "You can stop there." "I believe I will," he said, standing a few strides distant. "So, I'm the dog man, and you know it. Who might you be?" "You remember Rattleneck, aye?" "Of course, but you ain't him." "No, I'm his son." Dogman frowned and drew his bowstring back a touch tighter. "You'd best make your next answer a damn good one. Nine Fingers killed Rattleneck's son." "That's true. I'm his other son." "But he was hardly more than a boy." Dogman paused, counting the winters in his head. "Shit. Is that long ago?" "That long ago." "You've grown some. That's what boys do. You got a name now?" "Shivers, they call me." "How come?" He grinned. "Because my enemies shiver with fear when they face me." "That's so?" "Not entirely." He sighed. "Might as well know now. First time I went out raiding, I got drunk and fell in the river having a piss. Current sucked me trousers off and dumped me half a mile downstream. I got back to the camp shivering worse than anyone had ever seen. Fruit sucked right up into my belly and everything." He scratched at his face. "Bloody embarrassment all round. Made up for it in the fighting, though." "Really?" "I got some blood on my fingers over the years. Not compared to you, I dare say, but enough for men to follow me." "That's so. How many?" 20 carles or thereabouts. They're not far away, but don't get nervous. Some of my father's people from way back, and a few newer. Good hands, each man." "Well, that's nice for you to have a little crew. Been fighting for Bethard, have you?" "Man needs some kind of work. Don't mean we wouldn't take better. Can I put my hands down yet?" "No, I like 'em there." "What are you doing out here in the woods alone, anyhow?" Shivers pursed his lips, thoughtful. "Don't take me for a madman, but I heard a rumor you got rudd 3 trees over here."
"That's a fact."
"Is it now?"
"And Tull Duru Thunderhead, and Harding Grimm, and Black Dow and all."
Shivers raised his brows, leaned back against a tree, hands still up, while Dogman watched him careful.
"Well, that's some weighty company you got there, all right. There's twice the blood on you 5 than on my 20. Those are some names and no mistake. The sort of names men might want to follow."
"You looking to follow?"
"Might be that I am."
"And your carles, too?"
"Them too."
It was tempting, the dogman had to admit. 20 carles, and they'd know where Bethod was at, maybe something of what he got planned. That'd save him some skulking around in the cold woods, and he was getting good and tired of wet trees. But he was a long way off trusting this tall bastard yet. He'd take him back to the camp
and three trees could weigh up what to do. All right, he said. We'll see. Why don't you step off up the hill there, and I'll follow on a few paces behind. All right, said Shivers, turning and trudging up the slope, hands still up in the air. But watch what you do with that shaft, eh? I don't want to get stuck for you not looking where you're stepping. Don't worry about me, big lad. The dog man don't miss no... Gow! His foot caught on a root, and he lurched a step and fumbled his string. The arrow shot past Shivers's head and thudded wobbling into a tree just beyond. Dogman ended up on his knees in the dirt, looking up at him, looming over, clutching an empty bow in one hand. Piss, he muttered. If the man had wanted to, Dogman had no doubt he could have swung one of those big fists down and knocked his head off. Lucky you missed me, said Shivers. Can I put my hands down now? Dow started as soon as they walked into the camp, of course.
Who the hell's this bastard?
He snarled, striding straight up to Shivers and staring him out, bristling up to him with his axe clutched in his hand. It might have looked a touch comical, Dow being half a head shorter, but Shivers didn't seem much amused, nor should he have.
He's...
the dogman started, but he didn't get any further.
He's a tall bastard, eh? I ain't talking up to a bastard like him. Sit down, big lad.
And he threw his arm out and shoved Shivers over on his arse. The dogman thought he took it well, considering. He grunted when he hit the dirt, of course. Then he blinked. Then he propped himself on his elbows, grinning up at them.
I reckon I'll just stay down here. Don't hold it against me, though, eh? I didn't choose to be tall, any more than you chose to be an arsehole.
Dogman winced at that, expecting Shivers to get a boot in the fruits for his trouble, but Dow started to grin instead.
Chose to be an arsehole. I like that. I like him. Who is he?
His name's Shivers, said the dogman. He's Rattleneck's son.
Dow frowned.
But didn't Ninefingers his other son? But he'd be no more than a... Work it out.
Dow frowned, then shook his head.
Shit. That long, eh? He looks like Rattleneck,
came Tull's voice, his shadow falling across them.
Bloody hell, said Shivers. I thought you didn't like tall folk. It's two of you standing on top of each other, innit?
Just the one.
Tull reached down and pulled him up by one arm like he was a child fell over.
Sorry about that, greeting friend. Those visitors we get, we usually end up killing.
I'll hope to be the exception, said Shivers, still gawping up at the Thunderhead. So, that must be hard in Grim.
Huh?
Said Grim, scarcely looking up from checking his shafts.
And your three trees?
That I am, said the old boy, hands on his hips.
Well, muttered Shivers, rubbing at the back of his head. I feel like I'm in deep water now, no mistake. Deep water. Tulduru, and Black Dow, and... Bloody hell, you're three trees, eh?
I'm him.
Well then, shit. My father always said you was the best man left in all the North, that if you ever had to pick a man to follow, you'd be the one. Till you lost to the Bloody Nine, of course, but some things you can't help. Rud three trees, right before me now.
Why have you come here, boy?
Shivers seemed to have run out of words, so the dogman spoke for him.
He says he's got 20 carls following him, and they all want to come over.
Three trees looked Shivers in the eye for a while.
Is that a fact?
Shivers nodded.
You knew my father. He thought the way you did, and I'm cut from his cloth. Serving Beth Odd sticks in my neck.
Might be I think a man should pick his chief and stick to him.
I always thought so, said Shivers. But that blade cuts both ways, no? A chief should look out for his people too, shouldn't he?
Dogman nodded to himself. A fair point to his mind.
Bethod don't care a shit for none of us no more, if he ever did. He don't listen to no one now but that witch of his.
Witch?
Said Tull.
Aye, this sorceress, this cowrib or whatever. The witch, the one who makes the mist. Bethod's dabbling with some dark company. And this war, there's no purpose to it. Angland? Who wants it anyway?
We got land aplenty. He'll lead us all back to the mud. Long as there was no one else to follow, we stuck with it. But when we heard Rudd Three Trees might still be alive, and with the Union, well,
you decided to have a look, eh?
We've had enough. Bethod's got some strange boys along. These Easterners from out past the Crinner. Bones and hides men, you know. Hardly men at all. Got no code, no mercy. Don't hardly speak the same language we do. Fucking savages, a lot of them. Bethod's got some down in the Union Fortress there, and they got all the bodies hung up on the walls, all cut with the bloody cross, guts hanging out, rotting. It ain't right. Then there's Calder and Scale tossing out orders like they're no shit from porridge, like they got some names of their own besides their fathers.
Fucking Calder, growled Tull, shaking his head. Fucking Scale, hissed Dow, spitting on the wet ground.
No bigger pair of bastards in all the North, said Shivers. And now I hear tell that Bethod's made a deal.
What kind of a deal? Asked Three Trees.
Shivers turned and spat over his shoulder. A deal with a fucking shanker, that's what. Dogman stared. They all did. That was some evil kind of a rumour.
With the Flatheads? How?
Who knows? Might be that witch found some way to talk to him. Times are changing fast, and it ain't right, any of it. There's a lot of boys over there ain't happy. That's without getting started on that Feared.
Dow frowned.
Feared? I never heard of him.
Where you lot been? Under the ice?
They all looked at each other.
Pretty much, said the dog man. Pretty much.
Chapter 43 Cheap at the Price.
You have a visitor, sir,
muttered Barnum. His face, for some reason, was pale as death.
Clearly, snapped Glockter. That was them knocking at the door, I assume.
He dropped his spoon into his barely touched bowl of soup and licked sourly at his gums. A particularly disgusting excuse for a meal this evening. I miss Schickel's cooking, if not her attempts to kill me.
Well, who is it, man?
It's...
Archlector Salt ducked through the low doorway so as not to disturb his flawless white hair on the frame.
Ah, I see.
He swept the cramped dining room with a scowl, lip wrinkled as though he had stumbled into an open sewer.
Don't get up!
He spat at Glockter.
I wasn't planning to.
Barnum swallowed.
Can I get your eminence any...
Get out!
Sneered Salt. And the old servant nearly fell over in his haste to make it to the door. The Archlector watched him go with withering scorn.
The good humour of our previous meeting seems a vaguely remembered dream.
Damn peasants!
He hissed as he slid in behind Glockter's narrow dining table.
There's been another uprising near Kell, and this bastard the Tanner was in the midst of it again. An unpopular eviction turned into a bloody riot. Lord Finster entirely misjudged the mood, got three of his guards killed, and himself besieged in his manor by an angry mob, the halfwit. They couldn't get in, fortunately, so they satisfied themselves with burning down half the village.
He snorted.
Their own damn village. That's what an idiot does when he gets angry. He destroys whatever's nearest, even if it's his own house. The open council are screaming for blood, of course. Peasant blood, and lots of it. Now we have to get the Inquisition going down there, root out some ringleaders, or some fools who could be made to look like them. It should be Finster himself we're hanging, the dolt, but that's hardly an option.
Glockter cleared his throat.
I will pack for Keln immediately.
Tickling the peasantry, hardly my choice of task, but...
No, I need you for something else. Dagoska has fallen.
Glockter raised an eyebrow.
Not so great a surprise, though. Hardly enough of a shock, one would have thought, to squeeze such a figure as His Eminence into my narrow quarters.
It seems the Gurkhas were let in by a prior arrangement. Treason, of course, but at a time like that, hardly surprising. The Union forces were massacred, such as they were, but many of the mercenaries were merely enslaved, and the natives, by and large, were spared.
Gurkish mercy,
Who could have thought it? Miracles do happen, then. Salt flicked angrily at a speck of dust on one immaculate glove.
I hear that when the Gurkish had broken into the citadel, General Visbrook killed himself rather than be captured.
Well, I never. I didn't think he had it in him.
He ordered his body burned so as not to give the enemy any remains to defile. Then he cut his own throat. A brave man, a courageous statement. He will be honoured in open council tomorrow.
How wonderful for him. A horrible death with honour is far preferable to a long life in obscurity, of course. Of course, said Glockter quietly. A brave man.
That is not all. An envoy has arrived on the very heels of this news, an envoy from the Emperor of Gurkle.
An envoy?
Indeed. Apparently seeking peace.
The Archlector said the word with a sneer of contempt. Peace?
This room seems rather small for an echo.
Of course, Your Eminence, but...
Why not? They have what they want. They have Dagoska, and there is nowhere further for them to go.
No, Archlector. Except perhaps across the sea.
Peace! It sticks in the craw to give anything away. But Dagoska was never worth much to us. Cost us more than we made from it, if anything. Nothing more than a trophy for the king. I dare say we're better off without it, the worthless rock.
Glockter bowed his head. Absolutely, Your Eminence. Although it makes one wonder why we bothered fighting for it.
Unfortunately, the loss of the place leaves you with nothing to be superior of.
The Archlector looked almost pleased. So it's back to plain old Inquisitor, eh? I suppose I'll no longer be welcome at the best social gatherings.
But I have decided to let you keep the title, as Superior of Adua.
Glockter paused. A considerable promotion, except that... Surely, Your Eminence, that is Superior Goyle's role?
It is, and will continue to be.
Then...
You will share the responsibilities. Goyle is the more experienced man, so he will be the senior partner and continue running the department. For you, I will find some tasks suited to your particular talents. I'm hoping that a little healthy competition will bring out the best in you both.
More than likely it will end with one of us dead, and we can all guess who the favourite is. Salt gave a thin smile, as though he knew precisely what Glockter was thinking.
Or perhaps it will simply demonstrate that one of you is superior to the other.
He barked a joyless laugh at his own joke, and Glockter gave a watery, toothless grin of his own.
In the meantime, I need you to deal with this envoy. You seem to have a way of handling these cantics, though you might avoid beheading this one, at least for the time being.
The Archlector allowed himself another minuscule smile.
If he's after anything more than peace, I want you to sniff it out. If we can get anything more than peace from him, then of course, sniff that out too. It would do no harm if we could avoid looking like we got our backs whipped.
He stood awkwardly and manoeuvred himself out from behind the table, all the while frowning, as though the tightness of the room was an intentional affront to his dignity.
And please, Glockter, find yourself some better quarters. A superior of Adua living like this? It's an embarrassment.
Glockter humbly bowed his head, causing an unpleasant stinging right down to his tailbone. Of course, Your Eminence. The Emperor's envoy was a thick-set man with a heavy black beard, a white skullcap, and a white robe worked with golden thread. He rose and bowed humbly as Glockter hobbled over the threshold. As earthy and humble-seeming as the last emissary I dealt with was airy and arrogant. A different kind of man, I suppose, for a different purpose.
Ah, Superior Glockter, I should have guessed.
His voice was deep and rich, his mastery of the common tongue predictably excellent.
Many people on our side of the sea were very disappointed when your corpse was not among those found in the citadel of Dagoska.
I hope you will convey my sincere apologies to them.
I will do so. My name is Tulkis, and I am a counselor to Uthman ul-Dosht, the Emperor of Gurkul.
The envoy grinned, a crescent of strong white teeth in his black beard.
I hope I fare better at your hands than